And I want to talk about self-image and denial. Sometimes I don't think that we really appreciate how powerful and insidious this can be. My talk wants to address what the Buddha called mental formations or fabrications that cause us and others suffering, but which are hidden from our conscious awareness by subconscious denial or suppression, because they conflict with our self-image. We have a lot of mental formations. They are ideas, attitudes, assumptions, the content sort of in the back of our mind. What we study when we practice mindfulness of mind, like the things that are in the back of our closet, these mental formations tend to be old, and we have probably forgotten that we even have them. Haven't seen them in a while. We may not remember forming those notions. Most of them are like fears or resentments or beliefs that are common in the society at the time that we absorb them. They were in the air and we kind of took them in, didn't even know it. One of the most harmful kinds of mental formations have been around for millennia. They're the ones that support the way that societies oppress and exploit some groups who look or behave differently than the groups in power. Now, however reprehensible these ideas are, the ones that demean less powerful groups, they may be absorbed unconsciously, but we end up being stuck with them. And they help maintain the ability of the dominant groups to hold down and take advantage of the less powerful groups. You know, we even acquire attitudes like this when we're members of the groups that are looked down on. I can remember in my years working with the women's movement that I was shocked to realize that I even had some of the ideas about the inferiority of women or the prejudices against lesbians. And I had some work to do to deal with those. Ultimately, attitudes like this that arise out of separating people into opposing categories will cause suffering to everyone in the society, not just those who are oppressed. Now, mindfulness practices aimed at liberation, the uprooting of all causes of dukkha, which are often these very semi-conscious mental formations that I'm talking about. And because they're kind of hidden in the cracks of our subconscious, it takes conscious, intentional effort to take the power out of them. And in fact, we may not know that we have them until we do something that makes it obvious. And in something that may be even more painful, when someone tells us that we seem to think that way, or the way it often feels when that happens, that we're being accused of being a bad person. I can remember someone telling me a joke back in 1981 about a doctor in surgery saying they couldn't operate on the patient. And the gist of the joke was that that surgeon was the wife and not the husband. And I missed it. I just assumed that it was a man. But when I was accused, I mean, the person who told it to me said, "See, you're sexist." I felt attacked personally. So in order to dig out these attitudes completely, we need to use our mindfulness practice and deeply study the mental states, these formations, fabrications. We need to watch how they make us feel. And that's why for over a decade now, when I lead a meditation, I talk about noticing when we have a thought and then seeing the feelings that come along with it and stay with that feeling as long as it persists. And that's actually the way we find our way from the thought to the underlying attitude or other mental formation that's causing these thoughts to arise. Over time, doing this, we will see how they lead to suffering, to dukkha, for us and for others. One of the basic teachings of Buddhism on non-harming and duality shows that harm to ourselves is also harm to others, and vice versa. The main difficulty we face in this study of the mind's tendency to obstruct our even seeing our attitudes is the unconscious technique of denial and suppression that cause us to answer when somebody asks us, "Well, why did you do that?" "I don't know why I did it." In a real sense, we don't. Now, it's our own shame over these states of mind, like my sexism when I got caught in that joke, that makes it so hard for us to understand them and let them go. Feeling that shame may make us briefly feel virtuous, that at least we want to disavow those thoughts or behaviors. But feeling bad about thoughts doesn't keep them from occurring again. So we have to be kind of like detectives and fairly brave ones. There's a phrase I love a lot in the most daunting of the 12 steps, which makes it not just doable, but actually painless. It's the dreaded fourth step, the moral inventory. It's not just thorough, but it's also fearless. A thorough and fearless inventory. When we can face our shame or guilt and simply accept that we have this old fossilized mental formation, our fear of it dissipates. We become fearless. It lets us look into the jumbled and dirty corners of our mind's closets. Now, as we set out fearlessly to examine what's hidden in our minds, we find clues in how we feel after those thoughts arise. If they come from a state of mind that conflicts with the way we like to see ourselves, we'll usually feel some kind of clinging or aversion. In other words, dukkha. Either of these forms of attachment produce dukkha, whether we're clinging or trying to keep something away. What we're doing when we follow those feelings is a little like a dentist or a doctor poking you to see where it hurts. That's what you want to examine more closely. Now let's consider why our subconscious resorts to denial or suppression. It's because having these thoughts conflicts with this image that we want to have of ourselves. We want to come across as a good person. We don't like finding out that we have bad thoughts and feelings. So we work hard to distance ourselves from bad attitudes. We use a lot of energy rationalizing any evidence that we do have these mind states. And if we're directly confronted with proof that we do, we may launch a defensive attack or run and hide or just crumble. I think that's what I finally did with that sexist joke. We are so attached to our self-image that we're almost unable to cope with having contradictory thoughts or behaviors. When it comes down to truth or self-image, truth usually loses. Very few of us want to be despicable in the eyes of others or our own eyes. The idea of self is the villain in a mass cover-up. Our identification with the idea of self is enforced by the notion that people are either good or bad, that we are all separated into immutable types of people, like once a bigot, always a bigot. But the third characteristic of all phenomena, anicca, shows that it's all impermanent. Every bit of it. We're all impermanent. Our minds too. When we lose sight of impermanence and forget that all phenomena are interconnected, then we get locked into categories that separate us. And this notion of being separate, permanent self, is the source of all our attachments and in turn our dukkha, our inner suffering. Nisargadatta Maharaj was an Indian guru who died in 1981 after a long and prolific life of teaching and writing. He said, when you know beyond all doubting that the same life flows through all that is, and you are that life, you will love all naturally and spontaneously. But when you look at anything as separate from you, you cannot love it, for you are afraid of it. Alienation causes fear, and fear deepens alienation. It is a vicious cycle. Only self-realization can break it. Go for it. Resolutely. So by separating people into categories, such as being a good or a bad person, we reinforce that key source of dukkha, the sense of self. And the fear of being bad leads to denial. But that denial doesn't entirely silence our inner voices beating us up for having ideas that we didn't choose and we're only vaguely aware of. This syndrome keeps us anxious and makes it hard to face our inner attitudes directly. All this mental effort to maintain our illusion of self is very stressful. It's our contribution, really, to the rampant anxiety in this extremely individualistic society. So let's quickly sum it up so far. We're attached to three ideas. One, that I'm a separate person in my own right. Two, I have been and will be that person all my life. And three, I'm a good person. We're actually all interconnected and we're always changing. And we may have acquired some attitudes without knowing it, which we now label as bad. This is what gives rise to denial and makes it so hard to see that we have these attitudes. And that makes it really hard to dismantle them. To uproot these mental formations, these causes of dukkha, we have to be able to see them. First step. Initially, this means that we have to recognize that we're having thoughts that we would rather not have. This requires us to form the intention to notice and accept our thoughts, whatever they are, whatever they're about. It's sort of like just adopting the assumption that all thoughts are okay. Because otherwise, we go on living in a somewhat dirty house that we have no interest in noticing the dust, dirt, and clutter that aren't directly in our view. You know, that sounds familiar to me after, what is it now, 3.5 months of sheltering in place? I don't really want to see that stuff, at least until I have a housekeeper come back in. We have to accept that thoughts are not us. They arise without our choosing them. They don't define us, and they're not our fault. But if we find ourselves bridling at the sense that we're being accused of some attitudes we insist we don't have, it's a good clue that our self-image is tied to them. So all phenomena really are impermanent and inseparable from all other beings, and they have causes. To understand what causes our thoughts, we need to investigate them by feeling how they affect us. We practice accepting our thoughts during mindfulness meditation by repeatedly noticing them and accepting them, and then staying with the feeling they bring with us until we're able to sink into an understanding of the causes and conditions out of which they arise, our attitudes, our mental formations. Now, we don't linger over the thought itself. We just notice it and immediately turn our attention to our feelings as long as they last. Once the feeling fades, we just invite our attention back to the breath right away. And we do this over and over as we practice without clinging to any goal. We just do it because that's the practice. Eventually, this practice leads to insights into the deeper and deeper causes of our thoughts. And when we begin to see the connection between our dukkha and our self-image, we're close to being able to let go of the ideas that we've been clinging to. These deeper insights occur subconsciously and often quite some time after we've explored our mental formations. So just go ahead and credit all of your insights to our practice. Once we become aware of some attitude, we will notice it popping up sometimes in our behavior, or just a trace of a thought that flits through our minds when we're going through our day. So formal sitting meditation isn't the only tool that we have to investigate these states of mind. In daily life practice, we bring mindfulness to as much of our life experience as possible. And it's especially helpful here in getting to know and dismantle these troublesome mental formations. If we have the time when a troublesome thought arises, just use the same technique as we use sitting. And often we don't have the time right then, so journaling is helpful. At the end of the day, we can recall what the thought was and the uneasiness it caused, and explore it with either mindfulness or by writing it out in our journal. Or we could work with another person or a group to delve into the workings of our minds. As we increasingly get to know how our mind states work, they kind of loosen up like weeds that we've dug under with a trowel, and they either fall away or shrivel up. So just noticing habits of the mind is one of the most powerful tools that this practice gives us. It's one of the best tools in my recovery program too. Now, I grew up in the Army in the 50s where having a drink with someone was the way to socialize and be friendly. And so I absorbed that. And unfortunately, I turned out to be an alcoholic And those thoughts are not helpful to me anymore. But once I see what they are, they lose power over me. It's like the Buddha saying, "I see you, Mara," on the night of his enlightenment. Now, I still need to spot and disarm those thoughts, but I have been free from any real desire to drink for almost 20 years now. And when I feel the first hint of an urge, I talk to another alcoholic about it. I admit it and dismantle it. I do something similar with other thoughts that come out of social prejudices I absorbed as a kid. It reduces their power over my feelings and behavior. Are they gone completely? Well, probably not. I see it like weeding a fertile garden. As long as the seeds are in the air from anywhere around me, they could take root if my mind is receptive. The mother root of all attachments that makes the mind receptive to harmful mental formations is, of course, the delusion of self. Until that is uprooted, weeding will remain a routine chore. As we keep digging those weeds up, we learn to keep going deeper and deeper. Now, I'm not saying that this work is pleasant or easy, or that I myself am finished doing it. While having certain thoughts and suppressed attitudes may not be our fault, but it is our job to disarm and dismantle those attitudes, especially when they add to harm being experienced by others. No matter how hidden those attitudes are from us. Thank you.